I am back, and you are back, so let's fire up the airwaves with another episode of this thing of ours that we reference as the Far Middle. Nick DeOlius talking to you at the start of another fine June. Perfect. And I just had the pleasure of dropping in on another awesome experience at the annual camp for this week's dedication subject. Western Pennsylvania is steeped in football tradition, the cradle of quarterback legends alone. You got Joe Namath, George Blanda, Johnny Unitas, Joe Montana, Dan Marino, and Jim Kelly. And beyond those legendary QBs or quarterbacks, the region I call home, it could fill Canton at the Hall of Fame with its own dedicated wing of current and future members. But that stack legacy of legendary names, you know, it sometimes makes it easy to gloss over one of the most impactful native sons of the sport here. In the region's coaching tree, there is a giant who enjoys both icon status among the football elite, but also an unsung status across the general fan base. And that's no offense to Bill Cowher or Mike Ditka, but the most accomplished football coach from Western Pennsylvania is a position coach who became the godfather of offensive linemen. And he's the greatest name in the region's football history that you probably never heard of. His name is Joe Moore. Coach Moore started coaching at the high school level, and during his first year at a high school, 10 minutes from where I'm sitting, he coached a defensive captain who was a kid at the time by the name of Kirk Ferentz, who went on to great things at Iowa, becoming its winningest coach, and today stands, by the way, as the longest tenured head coach at a single FBS program. How about that for Coach Ferentz? But Coach Moore's legend, however, was made, I think, really at the collegiate level. There's no doubt about that. He started at Pitt in 1977. He was part of Jackie Sherrill's staff, and he just led an epic 9-year run of unprecedented talent development of offensive linemen. The names that he nurtured to greatness at Pitt, it's a generational who's who of the offensive line. You got Bill Frelick, Mark May, Russ Grimm, Emil Burris, and Jimbo Covert in that group. And after Pitt, Coach Moore eventually landed at Notre Dame, and in 1988, he began a 9-year run there. Over those 9 years for the Irish, he sent all but two of his starting offensive linemen to the NFL. Ponder that for a success rate for a moment. Every starting offensive lineman went on to the NFL during his 9-year run at Notre Dame, except for two. So yeah, the player names and tenure, they're impressive to the sports fan. But those aren't the main reasons why he is a dedication subject. The main reason plays more to the everyday person out there, sports fan or not. You see, Joe Moore, he was a direct to the point man. He was an intimidator, but in a good way. There were zero airs and graces about him. He simply oozed Western Pennsylvania through and through. He had the perfect personality and style for instilling greatness and realizing raw potential with a rough, unpolished group of talent. And his style was optimally suited to develop boys into men. One of his most famous sayings captured his philosophy when it came to sort of mentoring and coaching linemen. He said, "There's no greater feeling in life than moving a man from point A to point B against his will." Now, he loved teaching the fundamentals, and he was a master at manipulating players mentally to motivate them and prepare them for competition. And as he would often say, those around him, they would love him at times, hate him at times, but they would kill for him all the time. And his linemen through the years may have had, say, Jackie Sherrill or Lou Holtz as their head coach, but they all, in the end, played for Joe Moore. There was a 1984 interview where Coach Moore said, "If there's one thing I instill in players, it's to never be satisfied and to always try to do better in anything you do. They have to realize how good they can be first. Then I try to help them. They are the ones who become workaholics, not me." Now, sadly, we lost Joe Moore much too early in 2003. And although the man may be gone, his memory lives larger than ever. And his memory is evident both publicly and privately. Now, Coach Moore's public memory is embodied in the Joe Moore Award. The Joe Moore Award is awarded annually to the best collegiate football offensive line unit. You might have seen sort of the award on ESPN when it's that time of year for picking the offensive line to receive it. And it's presented by the Joe Moore Foundation for Teamwork, and it recognizes the toughest, most physical offensive line in the country. The Joe Moore Award is the only major college football award, by the way, to honor a unit or a group, not an individual. So team effort is going to be required to win it. I'm not sure if you knew that, and that's certainly an anomaly in this me-first world of today. Another visible aspect of Coach Moore's legacy is the Joe Moore O-line camp that's held every summer in suburban Pittsburgh. That's where I was this past weekend. The camp provides high school players the chance to be instructed in the craft by an impressive list of former Joe Moore players, headed by NFL Hall of Famer Russ Grimm. So the star-studded coaches who regularly attend the camp are testament, I think, to the lasting impact that Coach Moore had on them decades ago in college. And the CNX Foundation's Mentorship Academy, that's something I've spoken about on past Far Middles, something I'm heavily invested in. It also partners with the Joe Moore O-line camp. We sponsor players from the Mentorship Academy from urban and rural school districts here in Western Pennsylvania to attend the camp. And it is a great, awesome combination. So trust me on this, constant listener. If you study leadership and if you're competing in, say, business or in the arts, you can learn a lot from the Joe Moore legacy. He wasn't an offensive line football coach. He was a leadership guru. It was great to get Coach Moore in as a dedication topic for the Far Middle. It's crazy that it took 159 episodes to do so, but the timing of that O-line camp this past weekend provided the perfect opportunity to do so. So let's go from Coach Moore, who was sort of a leader of young adults or a leader of men. Let's talk about another leader, not just of young adults or men and women, but of a nation and frankly, the world or the free world at the time. Let's go back to 1961. And right at the very start in January, and talk about a leader, this one, again, not on a playing field, but on a global stage. Back in January 61, President Eisenhower was about to leave office, and he delivered what was effectively a farewell address on radio and TV to the American public. The speech was during primetime at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, and it became known through history as the Military-Industrial Complex speech. Now, if you give that speech a read today, there are a handful of core themes that President Eisenhower highlights that were very forward-looking. It's as if Ike was warning us back in 1961, what, over 60 years ago, of the dangers facing not just America, but Western Republican democracies in general. President Eisenhower must have had a crystal ball, and perhaps it was the same crystal ball that he borrowed from George Orwell, who had it before him. Freaky. Now, the military-industrial complex speech, it's largely been forgotten in today's society, so it deserves a refresh, and the Far Middle is a perfect platform to do so. And you can find the entire transcript of the speech without too much pain or effort on the internet. I was able to grab a copy online from the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library Digital Archives, if you're interested. The speech kicks off, as you would expect, from a farewell address with the president in the White House a few days from departure. And that first part of the speech, it's interesting in and of itself. But then about a third of the way through the speech, Eisenhower starts to highlight some really crucial themes. And the first is to acknowledge that America at the time was facing what he referenced as a hostile ideology. One that was, again, using his phraseology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Now, what great descriptors, right? Global in scope, atheistic, ruthless in purpose, insidious in method. It paints quite the picture, doesn't it? And President Eisenhower was describing, of course, communism at the time. Now, today, communism, or its close cousins of totalitarianism and socialism, they manifest with the left. And you think of the left today across our society, and you go back to President Eisenhower's phraseology for communism. Indeed, the left is global in scope. It is certainly atheistic in character, as it looks to subvert religions because, frankly, it views them as competition because leftism is a religion unto itself. Yeah, it is ruthless, as we have discussed across various episodes of the Far Middle, patiently and methodically ruthless to boot. And it is insidious, with a capital I, working from within our historical and impactful institutions to coerce change gradually and everywhere. The left today eerily reflects the painting of communism by President Eisenhower back in 1961. Hey, just spend a day on any Ivy League campus to prove the point. But Ike was just warming up in his farewell speech at that point because he quickly followed that description of communism and leftism by pointing out that there are no silver bullets to pressing problems in life or society, and in the real world of geopolitics. So check this quote out. "Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties." You listen to that, and you can tell that Ike was worried about the danger at the time of the military complex using the threat of, say, communism as an opportunity to grab power. Now, the worry today is not about the military-industrial complex, but instead about the left. And there are many examples that we can point to today where the left and its acolytes in government, in academia, in media, they hype the silver bullet cures to problems, real or imagined, typically not because the prescribed cures will solve anything in terms of a problem, but instead because the prescribed cures further the overarching agenda of the left. Now, the official and public rationale, it's nothing but camouflage. And of course, the biggest example that instantly comes to mind is Code Red and climate alarmism, forcing a supposed energy transition to save the planet, when in reality, it's becoming increasingly clear that this has nothing to do about transitioning energy mix or cooling temperatures as much as it has to do with stifling freedom of choice of the individual and exerting more control of the state over the person. Now, I'm confident that President Eisenhower would have seen Code Red scheming the same way. And here's a cool passage from that 1961 farewell address. "But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs, balance between the private and the public economy, balance between cost and hope for advantage, balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable, balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual, balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance and progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration." Wow. That passage, constant listeners, it's a near perfect summary of the inspiration for the far middle. President Eisenhower in 61 was describing the genesis of this little podcast effort that was created 60 years later. And don't forget, this farewell speech became known as the military-industrial complex speech. And there was a reason for that, because President Eisenhower later went on to say that America at the time was spending more on military security than the net income of all U.S. corporations. Now, yesterday's concern about the scale of the military complex, it's been replaced today with a concern about the level of spending when it comes to things like entitlements to special interests and interests on the massive government debt pile and subsidy to favored entities via efforts like the energy transition. Those things have exponentially exploded in magnitude to the point where they are now, or are projected to soon be, larger than military spending, in a still dangerous and increasingly dangerous world, by the way. If you doubt this to be true, consider statistics as they sit with our current state of government budget, and consider this as sort of a sidebar connection. The U.S. government has run a budget deficit every year since 2002. That's for 20 plus years. And it didn't matter over that time whether America has been in a growth economic cycle or in a recession, whether there was pandemic or no pandemic, or whether we were militarily or financially in crisis, or if we were in peaceful sort of normal times. Every year we ran a deficit without fail. And consider how the deficit magnitude has tracked. In 2004, we had troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the deficit was $400 billion. 5 years later, in 2009, we went through the largest recession since the Great Depression, and the federal deficit was $1.4 trillion. Then last year, in 2023, we saw low unemployment, high economic growth, yet the deficit was $2 trillion. Our government outspent itself every year for 20 years running, and the degree of deficit outspend has exponentially increased. And it doesn't matter, again, whether it was during good times or challenging times. Now, if that bothers you, the following might absolutely freak you out, because mandatory spending by government already consumes nearly 3/4 of the federal budget, 73% to be exact. And now we have higher interest rates because of inflation caused in large part by excessive government deficit spending. Ironic, isn't it? Anyway, if interest rates stay at, let's say, 4%, which, by the way, is what the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, uses in its forecasts, just under half of all federal revenue will have to go to cover just interest payments in 30 years. But if interest rates go to 5%, then nearly three quarters, or 73%, of federal revenue are going to have to go to cover interest payments in 30 years. You can see where this is going. If interest rates go up to 6%, game over, because all, as in 100%, of the federal revenue will have to be applied just for covering our interest expense on the federal debt. And it gets worse. The CBO projects the national debt is going to increase somewhere, check this number out, just shy of $120 trillion in the next 30 years. Think of that. And almost 100% of that increased national debt will be from mandatory spending, interest payments on the debt, and entitlement spending being the lion's share of that mandatory spend, which means we're going to have to borrow about $116 trillion more of debt. And none of it includes military spending. Unfortunately, we've come a long way from the military-industrial complex concern of President Eisenhower back in 1961. Today, it's a case of the left's government complex driving out all other activity in the private sector and stifling individual freedoms and creating an impossible math problem when it comes to basic government finance. Okay, let's backtrack to our main connection of President Eisenhower's farewell address. Another interesting section of that speech saw the president stating the following: "In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist." Okay, once again, the president was doing the nation a service when he highlighted the danger and a risk of a special interest gaining undue power and influence within the corridors of government. He was worried about the military-industrial complex back in 1961. Now, today we have a similar concern, but with a different special interest. It's not the military-industrial complex that we should be worried about in 2024, but instead the left's environmental energy transition complex. And it is just as large and more influential than the military-industrial complex ever was. And it reflects, using the words of President Eisenhower, a disastrous rise, and it truly is misplaced power. And it's going to persist, as President Eisenhower predicted, without a rebuttal and a well-thought-out campaign to course correct. Now, you might be wondering, what would be the appropriate vehicle to drive a course correction? President Eisenhower provided the answer in his 1961 address. He referenced it as an alert and a knowledgeable citizenry. He saw such as the vehicle for the most effective way to compel what he called a proper meshing of the military-industrial complex with society and liberty. And it's never been truer than today, particularly when it comes to the insidious nature of the left and how it manifests in campaigns like climate alarmism. We desperately need an alert and knowledgeable citizenry. Easier said than done, I'm afraid, for sure, but nevertheless vital if we wish to preserve this wonderful human experiment known as the United States of America. Again, another driver and a motivator for the far middle, hoping to alert and create a modest degree of knowledge to all of you constant listeners with each episode. But the left today, like communism back then, it understands this. The left is not stupid, and it is quite adept at developing effective countermeasure attempts to prevent alerting and creating a knowledgeable citizenry. Eisenhower knew this, and that's why he warned about how a government contract can become a substitute for intellectual curiosity. He was lamenting that development as a threat to scientific discovery and innovative research in universities and laboratories. So today, it's much worse, because today the government contract comes with a requirement of pledging allegiance to the requisite ideology. So if you want the research dollar, you better bow in submission to the religion of the left. Now, Eisenhower's fear was that ultimately the government contract, through the vehicle of public policy, could itself become the captive of what he referenced as a scientific technological elite. My goodness, did he nail that one or what? Yeah, the elite class runs rampant over the Constitution and the individual American in modern day life. You won't use this type of stove. You're going to drive this type of car. You will get this shot. You won't read that book. You can't post this message. And you must think this way. The elite power grab over the individual is everywhere today. And Eisenhower would be devastated. Toward the end of the speech, Eisenhower put forth a warning that is sadly in some ways laughable today. He said, "One must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage." Yeah, go back to that sidebar connection of what all this government spending has created when it comes to a mathematically impossible to solve set of federal budget numbers. It represents, when it's all said and done, perhaps the greatest plundering of a next generation by a current generation in history. And it makes the sacking of Rome and the collapse of the Weimar Republic look like child's play. Worse yet, this modern day plundering wasn't from an invading army or a treaty designed to cripple a nation like that of Versailles. Instead, it was done from within by ourselves and self-inflicted. Now, that farewell speech by President Eisenhower in January of 1961, so he was about to move out of the White House, it would, I thought, provide great center of gravity for episode 159 of The Far Middle. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Again, eerily timely 60 plus years later. And I've been, I guess, on a bit of a presidential and time period kick of late. I've been reading up on a score of prior presidential histories, Nixon and LBJ, Eisenhower, of course, Coolidge, Calvin Coolidge. They've been intriguing individuals, and I think they've had really sort of fascinating presidential terms, and might have more to say on some of those, by the way, in upcoming episodes for a little foreshadowing. Stay tuned. And I've also been diving deep into specific time periods within our nation's history. The 1920s, fascinating period for America. The 1970s, they've always been of interest just because, if nothing else, I was alive but not yet old enough to appreciate how chaotic that time was. So looking back now and studying the 1970s in detail sort of gives me the opportunity as an adult to put a more colorful and complete context around my very early formative years and impressions. Hey, let's dive a little deeper as we wrap up episode 159 on that year of Eisenhower's farewell speech, 1961. Now, one of the top movies that year, in fact, the second most popular movie as measured by box office, remains a personal favorite of mine, The Guns of Navarone. It's a military-based movie, and it takes place during World War II, with Navarone being an island in the Aegean that the Germans occupied and installed a massive radar set of guided guns that threatened to disrupt convoys and shipping of the Allies. And there was sort of a commando team put together to blow up the facility. Now, the movie is an absolute historical fiction. Navarone is not an island, and the Germans during World War II, they never had such an installation. But it's the type of historical fiction that is awfully entertaining, bordering on mesmerizing for a young adult that had a passing interest in military history back then. Now, it hit the box office well before my time, again, 1961, but I was able to watch the movie many times over when it appeared on TV in the late 70s and early 80s. The movie sported an all-star cast. You had Gregory Peck, David Niven, and Anthony Quinn, and that is a lineup to say the least. And The Guns of Navarone fell within a series of great and epic war movies. It came a few years after the classic The Bridge on the River Kwai. And then right after The Guns of Navarone came the epic The Longest Day, which of course is about D-Day and the Normandy invasion, as well as Steve McQueen's classic The Great Escape. So if you're into World War II and into those types of historical movies, whether they be fictional or historically accurate, yeah, the late 1950s and early 1960s, they served as a sort of golden era for that genre. And if you jump over to when it comes to the music scene in early 1961, the Billboard charts show how rapidly pop culture was in transition during that time. There was a back and forth war between easy listening and early rock and roll for dominance on the charts in early 61. The year started with Elvis at the top with his single, Are You Lonesome Tonight? And Chubby Checker reached the summit of the Billboard charts in late winter, early spring of 1961. So rock and roll was starting to spread its wings. But in between those two, you saw easy listening dominating the top of the charts. Lawrence Welk, for goodness sake, taking number one on the charts in early 1961 after Elvis and before Chubby Checker reached the top. It's hard to believe that Elvis's Are You Lonesome Tonight was pushed off the number one slot of the charts by an easy listening acoustic single by a performer known as Burt Kampfert. The single was Wonderland by Night, and it's an instrumental with a big band playing behind a lead trumpeter. It held the top slot on Billboard for not 1 week, but for almost an entire month in early 1961. But then Burt, he was pushed out of the top slot by the female group The Shirelles and their classic Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow. But then after a few weeks at the top, The Shirelles fell to none other than Lawrence Welk, who was then subsequently vanquished at the top slot by Chubby Checker. So early 1961 Billboard charts, they show how quickly the nation and the tastes of its people were evolving. Back and forth battle for primacy between upstart rock and roll and the established easy listening genre. It must have been a topsy-turvy and fascinating time, albeit during a much more innocent period. So I envision battles of the generations over radio dials in the living rooms of America back then in the winter in early 1961. But hey, that innocence, I guess, would change soon enough a few years later when the late 1960s arrived. Isn't that the truth? I hope you're not lonesome tonight. And if you are, give a listen to a few prior episodes of The Far Middle in the archives. You can find them on your favorite podcast platforms. And of course, as always, you can find them archived on nickdeolias.com. We will talk again in a week.